This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Right.
Right. One is a heartless liberal, right? Which is how I felt like.
Yes, there you go.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming our very special guest for this week, Celine Coggins. Celine, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys.
Also joining me, my co-host, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike.
For those of you that don't know, Celine is the executive director at Grantmakers for Education, a relatively new gig for her.
She was previously
the founder and former CEO of Teach Plus.
Yes.
So, Celine, welcome and welcome to GFE. I am proud to say that Fordham is a member of GFE. We give just enough money away in Ohio that y'all let us come to your meetings. Thank you for that.
We love it. Yes.
And I never would ever think about violating the no solicitation policy at such meetings.
I sure hope you're not kidding.
Soliciting funders. That's okay. Just to be clear. All right. The way you looked at me. My goodness.
I didn't know what you meant.
All right. Well, there you go. So Celine, your organization is out with a brand new report, that looks at grant making in education. This is the 10th anniversary, the first time you all did that. So we're going to hear all about it in Ed Reform Update. Okay. Although really, maybe this is not a good fit for Ed Reform Update because the main conclusion seems to be that the funders are not really that interested in education reform anymore.
Yes. So, you know, this was fascinating for me as I came on board at Grantmakers for Education. The research had already been done and I was looking at kind of the first cut of the data. And this huge headline jumped out. Number one, you saw these precipitous drops just from 2015 to 2018. In funder commitment to areas like standards, assessment, teacher quality, the kind of pillars of education reform as I knew them. And then these huge jumps in areas like early childhood, social and emotional learning, wraparound supports for students, things that were, you know, kind of different from the core academic reforms that we've been working on for the past 10 years.
Oh, boy. Okay. So much to unpack here. Other than you must feel very good about your career choice that you made here, jumping from somebody who needed to raise money, especially for teacher leadership sorts of things, to someone working with funders. Good work, Celine. That was very smart.
Well, no. So it's really interesting. I mean, coming from that world and, you know, I was a founder. I was at Teach Plus for just over 10 years.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, made this kind of whole body decision to leave the organization for a whole variety of reasons. I felt like we were entering a new era and that new era deserved a new leader. I think that's been really good for Teach Plus. But at the same time, looking at this data, I was like, maybe it was because my fundraising challenges were getting more challenging.
Well, poor Roberto Rodriguez, who's been on our show and now has to pick up the slack there. Look, this is not really news to any of us who work with funders and try to raise money from them from time to time that the last few years have been quite difficult. And when you dig into your report, it's clear that part of what's happening here is, of course, around politics, that funders just don't see a way forward on some of the big national initiatives in the same way that they did during the Obama years. And, you know, you didn't have data on this, but I suspect during the Bush years as well. This is now a different era that we are in where we've got a president and secretary of education who aren't particularly interested in leading from Washington. Some of us think that's okay. But the funders, therefore, are not going all in on national education reform strategy.
Yeah. I think there's a definite trend toward localism. So if you look, about 75% of respondents said that they thought that the local context was good for the things that they cared about, but 0% thought the federal context was kind of highly conducive. So
zero.
Zero or 0%, however you want to say it.
Smart
no one is looking to the feds for leadership.
Well, it's interesting, though, David, because, you know, I mean, there are grant makers out there that, for example, support school choice. And this is an administration that's very vocal on school choice. And, you know, so you could, it's a little surprising that even on that issue, they just don't see a lot of opportunity.
So what we found on charters specifically was that there has been a core constituency and that's basically held.
Yeah.
And so if you look at certain things like new school models, intervention in low performing schools, there's been a real drop off in funder interest on those, but the charter interest has kind of kept with its core constituency.
And yeah, that seems right to me. And look, the Walton Family Foundation is the huge player there, and they have remained steadfast. Thank you, Walton family.
Yes.
Yeah, Mike, I mean, I you may disagree with this, but I guess my question is, what's the problem here, right? I mean, I'm reading between the lines. I'm getting the sense that you're feeling like we have a problem, but I'm not sure that we do have a problem. Were we really going to spend the next 100 years just, you know, sort of redesigning tests and redesigning standards? All I mean, right. Can't we move on to other things having won that victory?
Well, it's a great question, and I think we can, but it depends how. I mean, my worry is that we are going to chase the next shiny object, which is somewhat how I would describe some of the social and emotional learning stuff. I mean, of course that stuff matters. It's not new that stuff matters. Schools have been teaching that stuff forever. And of course we know that kids need to feel safe in order to learn what they need to learn to be prepared for life. But, you know, to say that we should do that instead of academics, that would make me nervous. The other thing, David, I'd say, look, we need to finish what we started. And what we've started recently, especially with setting higher standards and having these assessments to measure whether we're teaching kids to those standards. And then, most importantly, changing teaching and learning in order to meet those higher standards. And it's all that work around especially curriculum and curriculum implementation, teacher coaching, professional learning, all of that stuff. I mean, no, we don't need to relitigate the Common Core wars. But if we're going to live up to the promise of Common Core and the huge investment that you know, a lot of these funders put into it, then we need to keep working on implementation, which is, and I don't know, fair to say that there's less interest in that than we might hope?
Yes. So no funders in this survey, and this is just, you know, its own cross-section, it's not everyone, said they anticipated growing their funding in the standards or assessment category over the next 2 years. And so for me, I think that's a really challenging one, because I spent the past decade of my life saying to teachers something that I really believed, which is assessment is a solvable problem.
Yeah.
We can get to a place where we have a basic set of tests that allow us to know how kids are doing in ELA and math that don't take the whole school year to prep for and administer. So let's solve that problem. And I feel like we got to the 98-yard line and we're like, this problem's really hard. We're going to pack up and go home.
Well,
that's worrisome.
Now tell me, Celine, but things like curriculum implementation, like coaching, teacher coaching, and I mean, is there activity there or not?
Yes. So I think there's definitely activity there. We hadn't asked the question about curriculum in the 2015 survey, and so we couldn't see kind of growth between 15 and 18, but we do see some activity there, and that's certainly the case. For me, I think one of the things that worries me is defining, even though it was narrow, one of our primary goals for school reform as being able to get kids to be able to, you know, perform on tests, allowed us to turn to folks at the state level and the legislature and say, fund this. We know what we're going for. We know what success looks like. And I think one of our challenges now is it's unclear if success should be more than just tests. Of course it should, but is that something we want to commit to our legislatures? And if we don't, are we going to continue to see kind of the funding challenges that we have?
Right. And then the teacher stuff, which is so surprising. I mean, here we have in the middle of all these strikes, and you know, yet you see funders, it feels like moving away from some of these things that really were about teacher leadership, teacher professionalism, you know, this sort of alternative to just the old union approach to those issues, something that was meaningfully empowering teachers, you know, but in a way that, you know, what was collaborative, maybe instead of antagonistic. I don't know. It seems like this would be the perfect time to be doubling down on that strategy.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, so my deep, longstanding and continued belief is that for teachers to effectively participate in policy, they need some training and understanding of the political context of how policy change happens. And, you know, and so I think that, you know, that's where the Teach Pluses of the world and the Educators for Excellence, I think, really serve a valuable purpose. And sadly, as I said, with the survey, I came in after the questions had already been administered. In 2015, they asked the question of, you know, who's funding Teacher Voice. By 2018, they had dropped the question entirely. So it kind of broke my heart.
That's not a great sign on that front. Wait, Celine and David, I'm curious. We've talked a lot this year on the show about this being a tough patch for education reform, certainly for policy reform. What's your sense? Is this just cyclical? We got to be in the wilderness for a while and we'll be back, you know, maybe, for example, after the 2020 election. What's your take?
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that, sure. I mean, I think this is a good moment to be really thinking about what do we mean by student success. And I think that the broadening definition is, you know, okay to an extent, as long as those pieces of the puzzle that we know are super important, standards, assessment, accountability, teacher quality, don't get lost in that process. And so for me, you know, I think that it is great to know that there's lots of science coming out that is helping us to really understand how the brain works and how social and emotional components of learning feed into being able to be successful in an academic way in school. But I don't think we've reconciled how those fit together in terms of what we're committed to as a school enterprise.
David, you're not worried by all this?
I mean, I'm a little worried. There's a hierarchy of needs when it comes to, I think, the Republic. And right now, education reform is just not at the top of people's minds. I continue to believe that, like, look, education reform, by which if we mean by that, that our schools could still stand to improve, mm-hmm. will always be there, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it will be there till the end of time. Mm-hmm. I do think I would like to see some sort of middle ground. I mean, I feel like we're jumping straight from assessment to socio-emotional learning, which maybe isn't quite fully baked.
Yeah.
Without stopping at the natural midpoint for me, which is thinking a little bit harder about accountability that's broader, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Long-term outcomes. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think we're kind of skipping over the heart of the issue there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm sure we'll come back to it.
Well, and as Celine says, right when we're on the 98-yard line. All right. Yeah. Again, we've been talking about trends in education philanthropy, benchmarking 2018-19, which you can find on the Grantmakers for Education website. Celine, thanks so much for joining us. I hope you'll come back sometime soon, maybe with better news.
Well, thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks again, Celine Bye-bye. Coggins. And now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, David and I just had a depressing conversation with Celine Coggins. Nothing we didn't really know, which is that the funders have basically abandoned K-12 education reform.
Wow. That's not what we decided. You were depressed.
All right.
I kept my head. Uh-huh. A cool head.
You do remember that we have to raise money for the studies that you do, right, David?
I consistently forget that.
Yes. All right. Well, Amber, give us something.
It's already been funded and paid for. And is already in a journal. Yes.
Oh, okay. That works. That's fine. And something that can cheer us up, maybe.
Well, it's not going to cheer you up. But but hey, it's an Eric Hanischek and Paul Peterson study in Education Next.
So these are the kinds of studies that convince funders to give up on education reform.
And they look at the patterns in achievement inequality over the last 50 years. They pull from multiple tests of students born between 1954 and 2001. Did you read this, Mike?
I did. Next?
All right. We hear a lot about the achievement gap, but this is one of the few studies to look at it over that long of a period of time. And they do it for intertemporally linked national representative surveys. Do we know what that means?
Sort of.
Sort of.
Yes.
It means the tests were designed to be comparable over time by doing things such as repeating some of the same questions.
Yeah.
All right. They draw data from four tests, the long-term trend NAEP, the main NAEP, TIMSS, and PISA. They include all tests administered to students at age 14 or thereabouts. And at age 17, in total, they compile data from 46 tests in math, 40 in reading, 12 in science, for a total of 98 linked tests over 47 years, totaling achievement data for over 2.7 million students. Mm-hmm. To measure students' socioeconomic status, they developed this indicator that uses parental education and home possessions as reported by students. Because we don't think kids know how much their parents make, right?
Right.
So we ask them things like, do you have a computer? Do you have your own bedroom? Do you have a dishwasher? And then they use this data from kids and from this parental education indicator to come up with this SES status measure. Okay. They analyze the difference in achievement between the highest and lowest deciles of the SES distribution. That's the 90-10 gap as they call it, and the difference between the highest and lowest quartiles, the 75-25 gap. The key finding, the achievement gap has not grown or closed. Over the last half century they studied, it has only persisted. For instance, in the 1954 birth cohort, the achievement gap between the average of those in the top and bottom deciles of the SES distribution was slightly less than 1.2 standard deviations. For those born in 2001, the gap is just slightly less at 1.05 standard deviation. And the quartile pattern looks largely the same. So in short, what I'm saying here is the most disadvantaged kids have made the same gains in achievement over the decades as those realized by the most advantaged kids. Like the patterns, the gap continues to look. Right.
Yeah. And by the way, gains is important to say, at least at age 14, that there were gains.
You've read the study.
There's really? A rising tide. This is the good news in the study.
I'm getting there, kind of.
Didn't get much attention.
When looking at the subject area, they find similar patterns with the 75-25 math achievement gap narrowing slightly, but reading is flat, Mike. I mean, almost the entire period flat. They also use another measure of SES just to make sure. They use this gap between those eligible for free and reduced lunch and those not on main NAEP, because I think, well, maybe this other measure we have is funky, right? And then they look at that over a short amount of time because they don't have that NAEP measure for the whole time. And it also showed minuscule change over the past two decades. As for the black-white achievement gap, there was sizable shrinking in the early period of the analysis, but little change across the last two decades. Mm. Next, I'm almost finished. They investigate whether change in the racial ethnic composition of the school population is a huge factor. That's why everybody wants to know that, right? And they find whites have declined from 75% of the population to 55% during the past half century, but they find little strong evidence that it accounts for the divide.
Yep.
Finally, they look at whether all achievement is rising despite these gaps. Mm-hmm. Your question, rising tide lifts all boats. It shows an upward trend in the achievement level for all students of approximately 0.3 standard deviation over the nearly 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
Though it differs by student age,
right,
which is your point. And basically, they find that 14-year-olds show an overall decrease of 0.43 standard deviation, but gains among 17-year-olds amounts to 0.10 standard deviation, so lower. But after 1970, they don't see improvement for those 17-year-olds.
The birth year's 1970.
The birth year. So that's right. That's like right.
Late 80s.
That's right. It was a while ago.
Yes.
Well, you know.
It's a while ago.
I just want to point out that I did graduate around then. That was probably the high water mark.
So the quote that you'll appreciate, quote, high schools do not appear to build upon the gains achieved earlier. Mm-hmm. A signal, perhaps, that the high school has become a troubled institution, end quote.
Mm-hmm. All right. So much to unpack. First of all, I kind of do wish they had done this for the earlier kids as well. Mm-hmm. I suspect, you know, at least based on what I think we know about NAEP, is that we've seen even stronger gains at the fourth grade level, especially for poor minority kids.
That's
so
right.
So you've got this pattern. It's that, you know, we seem to be making more progress in the younger grades. I'd say grade four than we do in grade eight, and more in grade eight than we do in grade 12. And why is that? Like, what could explain this? And, you know, people would say, look, who cares about grade four and grade eight? What matters is grade 12. That's at the end of the system. Otherwise, we just got stuff fading out. Just like preschool fades out, then maybe improving elementary school fades out.
Right. Well, at least on achievement, right? There's a lot of other stuff that probably we can't measure that we don't know whether fades out or not.
Right, not just achievement. Right. Achievement. There might be other benefits to the fact that now fourth graders can read in a way that they
can. And they don't know either. They have a really nice discussion, you may remember reading in EdNext, where they say, well, we had all this stuff happen, like we have more single mothers, but we also have overall education has increased. So do they balance each other out? And they give you like three or four examples of sort of like a good thing and then a bad thing and say, oh, is it all just kind of in the wash?
Right, and that may be a teacher quality factor.
That's right.
You know, we, of course,
women have more opportunities.
Women have more opportunities. And that maybe for some reason that seems to be the, hitting us hardest at the high school level.
Mm-hmm. That's where I was going to go too, Mike, right? I mean, since we're wildly speculating, right?
Like,
you know, it's really much harder to come up with people who can competently teach calculus, right? Versus addition and subtraction. You know, I mean, like, it's important. The world grades are important, but with the right training, a lot of people, you know, can probably teach addition and subtraction reasonably well. I don't know. I mean,
calculus
is a Cadillac.
Or you could just look at scarcity, right? Yes, we continue to have plenty of elementary people who want to go into elementary school teaching. I think we also continue to, though, probably have plenty of English teachers. Mm-hmm. We do not have as many middle school and high school math teachers as we would like to have. I mean, those right. positions are. So, yeah, that's okay, right. that may be right. part of what's happening here. Maybe yep. there's been some changes.
And even, I mean, let's not forget the school funding quadrupled
yeah.
over the time, too. Yeah. So it's yeah. like, eh. Ish. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you want me to say, guys?
No, look, I do. So, I mean, look, it's like, it's these two things, though. You know, we have continued to make progress for the younger kids. Right. We have not continued to make progress for the high school students. Mm-hmm. And the progress is important. I mean, this is always this question about achievement gaps. Like, it is important to track this stuff, and it is motivating to talk about how we, for the cause of equity, we want to see achievement gaps narrow. On the other hand, it is really hard to claim that if you have, you know, both rich and poor making solid gains, that that's somehow bad news, mm-hmm. at least to me,
right.
you know, as right. as a, you know, compassionate conservative here. I don't right. see it as something. I see, I guess some people on the left would say anything, you know, hey, they're happy to see, you know, more affluent kids or white kids just plateau or even do worse if it right. helps the cause.
Yeah,
of
we don't
I am
that.
Not there.
Right. We don't want
right.
to see
that. Well, and as a heartless liberal, right, which is how I self-identify.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah, I guess I just, one question I have is, like, what is actually realistic, right? It's yeah. not, it's a sensitive subject, right? But mm-hmm. it's no secret that a lot of billionaires, Mark Zuckerberg, whoever, are really smart, right? Yeah. Like, so, you know, like, what I guess my question is, there's no universe in which this gap actually disappears,
right? It may not disappear.
So
no.
when do we know?
No.
But at the same time, it's pretty obvious that we could be doing more.
Better,
we
right.
could be better. So. Right. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to get thrown in the towel, right? I don't think that's the right response. But I do sort of wonder, like, what are we shooting for?
Mm-hmm. Well, and you can look at other countries, and the gap is not as big.
Right.
You know, right. so that's instructive. Of course, there's mm-hmm. some states and some districts that have made more progress than others. So, right.
Yeah.
I look, to me, back to the conversation about funders, is that we can't give up on this, right? I mean, the only way we're going to keep making progress is if we keep working right. at it instead of changing the goalposts.
I don't think anybody's given up on the achievement gap.
Oh,
right?
come on, Amber.
Gosh,
are you kidding me? They don't.
Wow.
People are saying, oh, you know, academics not that important. What really matters is a social emotional learning.
Oh, I see. I feel okay. like they're adding to the conversation. Are they really giving up on the achievement? I feel like everything I read is about the achievement gap.
I don't hear people like, what we really need to do is focus on implementing high quality standards with a great curriculum. We hear a few people saying that, but not that many.
Right, instead, because we're like, having a hard time demonstrating the impact of curriculum.
So let's go chase some other thing. Let's just go chase and say, well, we can't close this gap, but maybe
right.
we
yeah,
can.
Yeah. No, I
no, we're
going
to go back to the self-esteem right. movement. And,
right,
you know,
we don't want that. I right. get it.
Just one more comment, which is, you know, there's so many things that are confounded here, obviously, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if inequality is increasing, right?
Yeah.
Then in general, right, for whatever reason, I don't know. I mean, I keep redefining victory, right? But I mean,
right. I see where you're
going. Chasing your own mm-hmm. tail, right?
Well, like, or you're holding steady against.
You're holding against the headwind.
Because
right?
other mm-hmm. analyses, Sean Reardon has made mm-hmm. the case that actually these gaps have increased because of income
right.
inequality, and they contradict his findings on that. So,
right.
you know, look, that again is the good news. It could be worse. You know, mm-hmm. that maybe income inequality is increasing. Now, we have a debate about whether true inequality is increasing. In other words, after tax and transfers, earned income tax mm-hmm. credit, Obamacare, et cetera. You know what? Somebody yeah. should write a book about whether our schools have gotten better in the last 25 or 30 years. you know, and somebody should fund that. Back
they
to the funding
should,
idea. Somebody
right?
should fund that.
Because we really don't have a straight
me.
Answer on that.
We do not. And we need to figure this out. All right. Whew, we could go on and on and on.
Yes.
But thank you. Fascinating stuff. Until next week.
I'm David Griffin.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.